All right, I'm back. Sorry about that, but we're back again. This is tape six, side one. The next couple of questions will deal with the scientific community overall. Where does most of your funding come from? Where does the bulk of it come from?
From NIH, National Institute of Health. And I've constantly have two so-called R1 type grant running. Mm-hmm. And that's R1 standing for the principal investigator initiate. And so basically just come to lab. And in addition, I've been supported by American Cancer Society and as well as Department of Defense for the breast cancer research, and of course, and the Pew Foundation, and some other sources.
Okay.
And on a smaller scale.
All right. To the average person on the street, the connection with breast cancer and the Department of Defense isn't natural, doesn't seem intuitive.
Does not. Yeah, it was not natural anyway at the beginning.
Right.
It's dictated by Congress.
Oh, I see.
And I don't think that was initiated by the Department of Defense.
Right.
Yeah. And the budget is good, though, and it doesn't cost them a whole lot of money at all, but and they give them a very good public image.
Right.
That they were involved in the civil research on something called breast cancer, and it can be more positive to the public image than doing things like that. Yeah. Mm. They actually, despite the little confusing start, and they're actually doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing pretty well. Yeah, they start seeing some impact on it.
Right.
Yeah.
Good. I mean, just I think last night I saw a story about, we all know about the rise in breast cancer, and then also the connection between now, I think, contraceptives that were made pre-1975,
yeah,
and the connection between the two.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a very
It is constant. It is a terrible disease overall, and not just breast cancer itself. This is probably one of the worst cancer among all the type of cancers. And for one thing, and then the disease itself is terrible,
right,
and the mortality is pretty high. And the second, we know very little about it,
mm-hmm,
and compared with some other type of cancers. For example, that the diagnosis of early childhood cancer, and it's pretty good,
mm-hmm,
and the treatment rate and is pretty high. And the rate of testicular cancer treatment is also pretty good. But the several major ones, in particular breast cancer, were not doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the part is because the understanding about its basis and the mechanism of development is still very, very poorly understood at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How does the source of your funds affect your research?
Not much. Not much, because in the most of the funding are pretty flexible, in particularly the funding from NIH.
Mm-hmm.
It's very flexible. And, I should say the Pew money is probably the most flexible ones. They just give you money to whatever you want. And but NIH is big money, and they don't have much. They have some restrictions, and because you have to think about when you renew your grant, and you have to tell review that what you have accomplished. But they don't check you. As long as you're not deviated too much,
right,
and it's all up to the principal investigator, which I think should be what it is, okay? Because science is a developing and field, and then it's not like a contract, and then you sign the contract with somebody, say I'm going to build your house, and you try to do as close as possible, if not identical, and as the way you contracted. But science is not. Okay, science is developing. We hypothesize something going to happen down the road, but nobody can predict exactly what's going to happen. Things changes,
mm-hmm,
not only by your own research, but also by the research conducted and published by your colleagues elsewhere. And so you have to be adjusting constantly to keep up, and to make the best out of it. So it's also the interest of the funding institution as well as the public as a whole, that the money is being the best utilized.
Right.
Okay, and I mean, it's stupid to stick to what they propose, and a lot of them will become outdated and already done by someone else, or become obviously impossible.
Right.
Yeah.
So in your mind, it sounds as if you believe that the person who knows best how that money should be spent is the PI.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that one. Yeah. It has to be the people in the lab to determine what they're doing.
Yeah.
Of course, when at the time they're making proposal, they have to make the best their knowledge at the time. But once the money arrives, and they just have to emphasize, encourage them actually,
right,
and to adjust constantly, and to keep up. Yeah, I mean, not that is not implying that you just jumping around doing everything randomly.
Right.
And in that field, the principal investigator has to make adjustment constantly, and otherwise the science will not be developed as fast as we would like to.
Right. Mm. Now, one of the criticisms I've heard about the NIH is that very often in order to get the funds, you have to do half of the research or have more than half of the research done, and that, in a sense, it doesn't encourage people to do sort of cutting-edge science.
Right.
Is that your own view, or do you have
I don't think it's my view. Okay. Right. And my suggestion is somewhat different from the view from the people that might have those views. I started my career in 1993, and the worst time is just over in terms of funding.
Right.
And there's a number measuring that. That's called the funding percentile. What's the cutoff? Say the worst time I heard was like 10 or 11 percentile, which means almost 90% of grant cannot get funded.
Mm-hmm.
So that's extremely competitive. Now it's get back to more or less normal, to 25 percentile. Okay. And when the funding is very, very tight, I mean, how are you going to discriminate in the different proposals? And that's become almost impossible. It's all good.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to say, well, this one has a higher chance of success. On everything else being equal. But what do you mean the higher chance of success? Which means more obvious, right? And so more obvious, and by definition, is less risk. And less risk means less potential of making discoveries.
Right.
So that's anti-intellectual, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's novelty, anti-intellectual, anti-science at the bottom. Okay, it doesn't mean it's always bad, but in general, that's not science. How science should be conducted,
mm-hmm.
And the science by nature it is making discoveries. Sometimes you don't know this, which means if you know exactly what to discover, which means there's no science, there's nothing to be discovered. If you know what you're looking for,
right.
You won't call it discovery. And by that nature, then we are doing something that we don't know exactly what we expect. We're exploring. So that the science should take risk, and it has to be on that part. And you just have to heavily rely on the tracking record. Someone is doing well and they're making discoveries, and they have a reasonable chance, not a guaranteed chance, they will be doing fine the next 5 years, and you give them money.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, part of a trend that has begun I guess maybe 8 to 10 years ago, and I think has increased, is sort of the privatization of biomedical research. And I know from doing a couple of these interviews that I think it's more likely now, or maybe more common, for postdocs and also graduate students to go into sort of private firms rather than, say, the university. At least that option is much more available maybe than it was before. Do you think that's a good trend or a bad trend?
I do. Okay, and for two reasons. Pretty obvious ones. That gives another alternative for the career development and project life,
right.
And for those people. And otherwise, and everybody and they try to jump and they try to squeeze in the same bus, and the bus is not picking up holding everybody.
Right.
That's one thing. And the secondary, that then the science traditionally is considered pure science and not so closely related to the public. So the public, they have this image of the scientists as nice people, but they're on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Weird sometimes. Described ways. And one reason is that they don't see much connection between the scientists and the science with their real life.
Right.
And they say that the bridge between the real life and the science is in the pharmaceutical company. And they say if pharmaceutical company can take our discovery to make a drug and treat a disease, then the public know what we're doing. I mean, who can do who will be good for those pharmaceutical company and do kind of translational or production research? Okay. And of course, it has to be the people that are trained by us. Yeah, and so I think that's one thing, and the public become more and more appreciate increasingly lately on the biomedical research and the preventive support. One of the reasons is because now they start seeing the product is coming out from the pharmaceutical end.
Right.
And a lot of pharmaceutical research, the product nowadays was based on the research discovery made 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the public can see that, and that's good. Yeah, that's okay. Good.
So two things then, sort of, again, the pharmaceutical, would be a better way of putting this, there's actually a product produced maybe at the end after all of these years of research, that would be one. So the application is clear to the person. Also, it allows another avenue of advancement, I guess, for up-and-coming scientists. Any other benefits that you see?
Yeah, and the science education is one to okay. The public, and now and ESG issue is coming out, and so that'll be the science and the law. That's mm-hmm. another issue, and that's also touch the science and the patent issue.
Right.
Also, you need knowledge in both the field of science as well as law field. like of course in the scientific base of management, because and to manage a pharmaceutical company, biotech company, or scientific administration job, and if you have a managing skill, and would be much enhanced if you also have some knowledge in the science field.
Right.
Okay. And so along those lines, and we now have this the genome project completed. And so this bioinformatics is still science, okay, but it's not the traditional sense of science or bench science anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more and more compute analysis, and so people don't sit on bench anymore. Those people, they're sitting on the computer or on the desk,
mm-hmm.
and you can still call those a scientist, but it's a different sense. They're not hands-on scientists. They use their head and on the computer a lot. Yeah. So in that sense, and the science training has become more and more broad.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you mentioned patents, and that's definitely been sort of a burning issue in the last couple of years. I mean, one of the benefits of being at a university is that there's this idea that there's this free flow of information. I think one of the fears that people have, not simply among the general public, is that when you have patents, all of a sudden that free flow is maybe dammed up. Do you see that? What is your own view of patents in biomedical research?
Well, the research part, I don't see much, and I only have one experience and one area, and the feel is that now it's become more difficult to receive the research material from other institutions, because every time you request something, which early on was just completely free,
mm-hmm.
okay, and by definition of your publication means that you are willing to make available to the community of whatever described in your articles. But nowadays, when you request something, and they have to go through all this paperwork, and it sometimes become almost a ridiculous requirement, and then just by providing a simple reagent, they almost own you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really going to obscure science development. That's not good at all. But in general, we're still enjoying a lot in the free exchange of reagent. And I myself emphasize a lot on that, and that we actually have a written protocol in the lab, and specifically indicating how do we handle the request. And so the line is pretty simple. If it's published, we send it out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and whether we're patenting or not, we're sending out to our colleagues.
Right.
If it's a company, and I don't see much point to restrict them either, because if they got to develop, it's good for them, it's also good for the public as well. I mean, ultimately, it's good for us. So we're sending out and any published reagent without any hesitations, and very quickly and in a very detailed manner. So I do have some expectation to my colleagues as well, to other peoples. And in general sense, I still think that's good, and we're doing all right. And I don't have much difficulty to get what I wanted from requested from my colleagues.
Right.
In the large sense, only a few cases, and I hope that's not going to continue to develop like a trend. And mm-hmm. that definitely will hurt the science in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and of course behind us is just patent issues. Right. I mean, they feel that if it's a patentable material, they want to hold on to it and to keep the possibility that. And that might have the potential to be developed for the commercial purposes.
Right.
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Do you feel, I mean, those protocols that you have in your own lab,
uh-huh.
do you feel those are fairly common among the community at large?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so. Yeah, but I just feel that science and it's ought to be the open research. And if you're hiding yourself, you close the door, you're dead.
Yeah.
So I personally really against that philosophy. So one of the practices that I take is that whenever people request something, don't hide.
Right.
And just because this is important to you, doesn't mean that you should not send it out to other peoples. Yes, and the sending out you might provide a little bit of a competitive advantage to other peoples, and that may be putting your competitor. And you can imagine that ways. But I think in other cases, people exaggerate that ones.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely is not right to practice, I don't think so, because
mm-hmm.
we are not using our own money, in a sense. We are using public money.
Right.
And the public doesn't care much, and who actually publish first, as long as they publish and the discovery is made. I mean, so you got to balance and what you're doing here, in the sense, and they're using other people's money, you're paid by taxpayers. I mean, why should you, what right do you have to slow down other people's?
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to think about that kind of issues.
Yeah.
Right. And ultimately, it's not going to help your science. Because if you close the door to other people are going to close the door to you as well. And mm-hmm. so ultimately, you're going to benefit either. So you just, nowadays, cannot do everything by yourself. It doesn't work that way anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have any patents, I think?
Yeah, we got several.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We talked a little bit about the makeup of your lab. How many women do you have in your lab?
It's fluctuate, and I don't know, I had more men or more women overall.
Right.
It's slightly, probably 60-40, men and the women, mm-hmm. like that was.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the common things that we see, I think it's common in the scientific community at large, is that whereas the breakdown of women and men is fairly, I wouldn't say equal, but you see many women graduate students, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets to the postdoc stage, unfortunately, the women tend to, especially the stage, let's say, from postdoc to PI,
yeah.
that the number of women PIs is extremely low compared to men.
Yeah.
Do you have any...
I don't like that. I don't like that. All right. And there are two things and two views on that. A, it has to be scientifically based. And then I don't like this racial bias or gender bias that promoted purposely by the government.
Right.
For example, I don't think I agree with energy policy that whenever you organize some meetings, the purpose asking you, is anybody a woman involved?
Right.
I don't think it's a very smart way to do this one. And they just make people backfire and just because she is a woman. And then why should her science be viewed any different from other ones? Because automatically you're going to generate a view
mm-hmm.
among the peoples. Okay. But on the other hand, and the women are competing with men on a disadvantaged stage for one obvious reason. That is childbearing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's physical things, and that just cannot change. And when people are entering postdoc period, so that's the time they're getting the late 20s, early 30s. And that's the time they have to think about a family. And the men cannot do it, and the women can do it. That can hurt a lot.
Right.
And we now imagining the career development in a very fast pace. Not many people realize that, that you have to graduate in 5 years. If you stay for 7 years, people think you failed.
Right.
You have to complete your postdoc in 3 years, because that's all the fellowship stopped covering for 3 years. After that, the fellowship runs out. You have to move.
Mm-hmm.
You have to move on. Move on can mean moving down or moving up. Moving up means that you become independent faculty. Moving down means you're looking for second postdoc. And that's a big detour. Usually it's not good. And you conduct your first postdoc, and then after 3 years, you have to, and it did good enough, it did pretty good, but not good enough to become independent faculty.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing a second postdoc, start over again. It doesn't help you at all. It doesn't. So that's a practical issue. Then that's a stage a lot of women are thinking about having family and then having child. And that definitely going to slow them down and for quite a long time.
Right.
And then I don't know what's the solution for that.
Hmm.
I don't know what's the solution for that.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I've been through that myself, and I've seen what happened to my wife. And I still encourage strongly to my student. But when it comes to reality and practical issues, I don't think I would have a good solution or advice for them. And then I have two and a woman student graduate. And the first one is now doing pretty well in a pharmaceutical company. She's actually doing very well. And she probably can continue doing this for a while
mm-hmm.
until she has a child. And that's why she's doing pretty well now, because she can still work just like a man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the second one just starting her postdoc. So they both are moving pretty well right now. And how long can she work? Can they move on down the road? I don't know. And I have a woman postdoc and left the lab. And she had a lot of chance, very good chance actually, to develop into independent faculties. I'm more than willing to supporting her, help her all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
But after 3 years, finished her fellowship, and she wants to get married and moving in with her boyfriend then, or husband now, and starting family, and to Atlanta, then starting a second postdoc. And it's not been very productive.
Right.
Which means that she probably will not have any chance to develop into independent investigator or as faculty.
Right.
Because people say, wait, you did okay in the first 3 years, not good enough. But what happened to the next 3 years? Nothing happening.
Right.
Yeah, because you have to start from scratch. Yeah. So I don't think that's good for her. But she wants family.
Right. What do you think can be done, though, to change that, or to at least, I mean, how do we keep these very promising? I mean, these women have obviously proven themselves to be scientifically capable.
I don't know. And I'm confused on that part. I have a mix of feeling, because as one hand, you want them to be truly equal,
mm-hmm.
but they're not, because they are women or women, men are men.
Right.
Only women can bear a child. I mean, I don't think anybody can change the fact. But on the other hand, then how can you how can you do that and without sacrifice the scientific merit? Because they are behind. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you judge these ones? And if one person and they publish three good papers in the during 3 years of period of postdoc training, and the other publish one paper and in 5 years.
Right.
Right. And when we review the grant applications, we don't look who is a man, who is a woman.
That's right. Yeah.
And so how you can only judge it by the scientific accomplishment. So that's reality.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a bigger issue behind that, I think. As a society, I don't know if it's a good idea or not to emphasize that. Because to overemphasize that, and you're encouraging women to continue walking and receive education. Now the education becomes longer and longer, training becomes longer and longer. And the postdoc was invented only last 20 years. Mm-hmm. Used to be that after you get your PhD and you move on to become independent research investigator or faculty. Nowadays, and after PhD, and almost like unspoken, unwritten rule that you have to conduct a postdoc research, minimum 3 years and usually 4 or 5 years. And when that, by that time you already finished and 12 years education and in the institute. Yeah, in your early 30s. And if you're lucky and you got your independent position, that'd be even more challenge coming on
mm-hmm.
to you. And what's time to have a good child?
Right.
There's no good time. What that means, you sacrifice your family. So the society has to consider what is good or not, a society as a whole, as a family, to continually, to constantly, sometimes I call it blindly encourage women just to move along with men, side by side, comparing.
Mm-hmm.
And how many papers you publish as a grad student, how many papers you publish as a postdoc, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's good for them or not. I don't know if it's good for men or not. I don't know if it's good for family or not. I would say probably not necessary.
Right. We know, too, that even when, let's say, a woman becomes a PI, there are, again, same issues. In other words, they have maybe 5 to 7 years to get tenure.
Yeah.
If they have children,
yeah.
That will extend that.
Yeah,
I mean, exception
and so yeah, now then the our university, and we have this policy that then even during the first 5 or 6 years and before your tenure is reviewed, then the female faculty had a child.
Mm-hmm.
So they can delay the review process by 1 or 2 years, I forgot. I don't see how that can help you, because since it doesn't work that linear mathematical way, that if I have a child, you extend my review process by 1 year. But unfortunately, it doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because, your institution can delay your tenure review by 1 year, but your grant review session and your peer and your publication doesn't work that way. For example, you can say, okay, and all my papers, publication delayed by 1 year, I can still publish.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they can say, oh, this story been published by another journal last year. You can't publish anymore. Just
mm-hmm.
because you had a child and we can view this paper or can review this paper as it was a year ago. It doesn't happen that way. So you can't change that.
Right.
So they are a fact and irreversible or not compensable way.
Mm.
And for the lot of the time they lost. Yeah. But they think about the loss for what? The loss for having child and a family. And is that publication tenure more important than that? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a difficult problem.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, a related issue would be ethnicity. What is the ethnic makeup of your lab?
Oh, everywhere. And on average, half from American. And the other half from foreign countries. And now it's become increasingly from foreign countries, from
mm-hmm.
Japan, from India, from China, these few countries, and one from Germany. That's become a trend lately that less and less American young people want to go into science.
Right.
Okay, the first choice, probably, I don't know what's the first choice right now. It used to be like a medical school. And that's just not far away from research because you can get a PhD first and go to the doctor or vice versa. But nowadays, and I don't know what's the first trend, what's the first choice, if they have the choice. I don't know whether it was the financial sector or the management or not. Yeah, but I think the biomedical graduate school is not the first choice for most people.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So we're increasingly recruiting more and more and 14 postdocs into the lab.
Yeah. And do you know what is the reason for that trend?
Well, the reasons are very simple. It's because of financial.
Right.
And take so long for biomedical research to become independent to establish because the postdoc are paid so little, okay. And by the time you become a postdoc, you're already a doctor. Okay, and after a long race, you still have to go through another 3 or 4 years, and at a low pay scale, and you still cannot start your real family life. Means that then they have a child, they buy a house, because how can you do it with like less than $30,000 a year payment,
right,
salary? You can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so and then when students graduate from college, think what they want to do. They talk to people. They realize if I go to graduate school, I spend 6 years there. And it's another 4 years and as a postdoc,
mm-hmm.
which means I can't buy my first house and start my family for another 10 years after graduating from college. Whereas if they would just go to another financial sector, and they can probably get a job easily and with another degree in 3 years. That's a comparison.
Right.
Yeah. Mm.
Okay. What do you like most about being a principal investigator?
Freedom, independent. I can really think about it and I can do whatever I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know what else can be more enjoyable than that. And I love it, it's a job.
Right.
Yeah, and you got an idea, you test it, and you make discoveries. Ah, aha, this is what's going on here.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's very independent, and I don't have to listen to anybody.
Right.
And we all want to be king of ourselves. And so I'm sort of like a king in the sense of running my own life and my own career. And of course, you have to be reviewed by your peer and by grant funding agency. But most of the time, you are pretty much running your own career.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, what do you like least
not,
about?
Yeah,
oh, sorry,
not to mention that you really feel good about what you're doing. And you go out, and we don't go out much often at all to get to know the public. But occasionally, and you talk to people on the street, on the vacation, on the beach, on the air flight, and ask them, what are you doing? Say, I'm a scientist. What are you doing? And as a scientist, so I'm doing the cancer cell biology. And instantly, and always, wow, that's good. And they don't understand what you're doing, of course, but they respect what you're doing.
So right.
That's a good thing to do this. And I don't know when people say, I'm a politician, I'm a lawyer, would they get the same response or not? I doubt it.
Right. Okay, what do you like least about being a principal investigator?
Sometimes it's going to be too stressful, and I didn't get enough time with my family.
Mm-hmm.
And, but this is not an 8-hour day job, and this is very demanding. And yeah, that's a trade-off. It's unlimited amount of work can be done, and you can see very clearly the correlation between how much time you invest into it versus how much things you can get out of this once. You almost finish unfinished.
Right. Could you describe for us a typical day for you? I mean, from the moment you get up in the morning to the moment you go to bed.
I get up late, usually, and then I really get up before 8 o'clock. I'm a late person. So I usually get up around 8:30, 9 sometimes, mm-hmm. even how late I stay the first day. Get up, and early morning in my house, in our house, and it's like running a battle. Everybody's pretty fast,
right.
Very, very efficient. So when my parents come in, they're just amazed, and we can hardly talk at anything. We just get up, take a shower, dress, drink a milk, just run to the car.
A clockwork, right?
Yeah. So they were amazed because it's totally different from the way they have the, like they get up earlier and then they cook breakfast, or sit down and eat breakfast, and they talk and they dress up, and then and they're walking around, then walk out. It's very different. It's very efficient. We take about no more than 40 minutes. From the time the clock rings and at the time we jump in the car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pretty quick.
Right.
Yeah, even Jesse was trained like that way now. And get into the lab and check an email and a message. That's the first things we do. And after that, then just start working. And I use it nowadays, it's different from before. Before I would and jump into the bench studying or continue the experiment I start left yesterday.
Right.
But now I don't have anything on the bench going, and so the first thing I do, I just sitting on the desk. I still come earlier than most people in the lab. So I would be doing all the paperwork, and while nobody else in the lab, and the reading something, or the writing something, for an hour or two. And so around 11 o'clock, I go to the lab, have a cup of coffee, and then start talking to the lab, the people in the lab, and one-on-one. And I try to talk to them as much as I could. Yeah, then have a lunch, and then continue talking to people in the lab, or doing the paperwork and the review grant or review papers and the writing papers like mm-hmm. that. And then around 5:30 and then go home, have a dinner and then play with Jesse. Around 8:30 or 9 I come back again. And then the evening actually is a very good time because it's quiet, there won't be any phone rings, and not much emailing going on back and forth. Mm-hmm. So I can either really do something writing, or I can talk to people in the lab in a quality way, okay? Really go through their result and analyze with them, and design a new experiment with them. Okay? Because a lot of them actually come back at night as evening as well. And typically, I usually stay here, the various actually, from sometimes 11, more typical, and to midnight. But if I really got something piled up, I have to write in, like I'm reading grant, and I have to get this done. And the best time actually is from 11 to 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that actually is the best time I can do something.
Right.
And there's no phones and no anybody, and so I can really concentrate. So if I do that, and then I come back to lab next morning, probably like after 10 or 11. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a typical day.
Okay.
And yeah, Saturday get up a little bit late, and then I stop by the grocery store, pick up donuts or croissant or bagels.
Sounds good.
They bring to the lab, and because the cafeteria closed on the Saturday,
oh,
and there's still a lot of people in the lab coming work on the weekend. Mm-hmm. They can't find a lunch somewhere, and so they don't need a big lunch, but need something. We have a coffee constantly, and then with some donuts like that.
Very good coffee, I might add too.
Yeah, well, I like that myself, and I also get people spoiled.
Right.
Yeah. So Saturday's a good time too. And then we can really sit down with the people and go through something and in a very detailed ways. Yeah.
The next couple of questions are kind of disjointed. They're just a few questions I'm going to throw at you. Where do your ideas come from to do your research?
Half from the discovery we made, the result we made in the lab, and the other half come from reading people's paper.
Right. Okay, do you feel that creativity in science is similar to the creativity you find in art? Do you think scientists are comparable in that sense?
They're comparable in the sense that the both has to be creative.
Right.
And if you don't have enough creative, you cannot be a good scientist. You can only be a good technician.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, in art, and in the sense that you have to think, but you have to imagine it. All right. But there's a constraint for scientific creative, because your creative can only be so wild that you make a hypothesis, but you have to test it
right
away, experimentally, at least in our discipline. If it's not testable, it's not science. I mean, that's the foundation of science. You can make all kinds of hypotheses, all kinds of theory, and no matter how fancy it might be and whether it be right or not, but if it is not testable experimentally, scientifically, then it's not science.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't consider it a science. I mean, we never test how old God is, for example. We don't think that can be testable. I mean, whether there's a God, I mean, we don't even bother to ask those kind of issues.
Right.
That's just not the science, right? And we're not saying it's wrong or right, but that's just not science, okay? And but that, I would imagine, I don't know this, and not necessarily true for art. And they can imagine something, they just keep on imagining. There's no boundary in the sense. And where the imagination can extend to. But there's a boundary as to what we can imagine. And that something has to be testable, scientifically, experimentally.
Right.
And then you have to develop on that basis. So it's a stepwise, it's limited, and it has to be scientific.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when you talked about Dr. Shen, you were saying that there were at least two different types of scientists, and you talked about a big scientist, big ideas. What distinguishes the two?
Distinction actually pretty clear, and okay, and then the most scientists, and I myself might be included as one, is just doing the routine science. You're making discoveries, and you don't jump. You're doing the solid pace and step by step. Keep on doing like that one.
Right.
And that's pretty natural way to doing this one. As most people doing this one. So there's another way, and you have this idea, very creative, very imaginative, and you're jumping ahead of other people's. And you are patient, you are persistent to pursue it, if you have a conviction to it, okay? You are setting up a higher standard to yourself to asking a bigger questions, not the small ones. The question that, if solved, could have a big impact, not only to you, to your group, to your own field, but also have clear implication to people that are not in your field. Let people think that people in other field think about, aha, that's the way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the difference.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. And where do you put yourself in that?
I would still put myself as a conventional scientist,
right.
And I have the highest standard, but it's not. I mean, subconsciously, I have to say I want, like many other young investigators like me, I have this dream and standard or expectation, setting by myself or by my peer, to do good science, to do big science, to make a big impact, have this ego behind these ones.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still trying to work on that ones, what I can get to that point, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. This we all have limited, if we are not realistic enough, we might just get into very frustrating, eventually might get depressed and feel that you actually failed. Just because you're not reaching the high goal, not necessarily means you failed. And I'm not very satisfied with what I have accomplished so far.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not. That's one thing, I keep on debating with my wife, she would say that you have to be realistic, and you're doing well, you're doing great, I don't feel that way.
Right.
I don't feel that way.
All right. Again, another question from left field. What do you do for fun? What do you do when you want to relax?
Outside the lab?
Right.
Traveling?
Oh, traveling.
Traveling.
Right.
So that's the one thing, both my wife and I love it. I love traveling. It's just going outside.
Right.
And that's the one thing I'm still doing pretty well in terms of separating the real life from the lab life, as
right.
I call it. I think I'm doing better than most other people at my level. In the sense that, if I go out for vacation, I really bring this with me,
right.
For the real vacation. I don't think about it. And I can do that once, and not really on the purpose. But if I go out, I just really go out. I can just put the lab behind me, and I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun to traveling around to see many things. Since early on, when we both were graduate students, we were still relatively poor. We couldn't afford to go anywhere,
mm-hmm.
and in the flying around the world or anything like that. But we were still, whenever we get a chance, we would rent a car and driving around, it's really fun.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever we get time, and we now financially it's not the issue that we could afford to do it, and the question is whether we can get time. But looking back, we were able to at least once, if not twice a year, make some long trip.
Mm-hmm.
And we travel a lot of places, a whole lot more than the people I know of, on
right.
average. Yeah, mm-hmm. We love it. Yeah.
So where do you go? Where do you travel?
That's one thing, and then my wife and I also share one thing in common is we don't like a big city much. Yeah, we've been in most cities, but we're not really enjoying the visiting cities. So
right.
We've been traveling a lot of parks and the outside things. We've been in probably two-thirds of the national parks of the United States already.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we've been in lots of more countries in the Central and the American, and so with my peer meetings.
Right.
We've been in Europe, and of course we've been in China, and Mexico, Canada, all these places.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still traveling. Whenever we get a chance.
Right.
Yeah. That's fun. Yeah.
Well, if you ever get out to California, I know we have some pretty nice parks as well. I definitely
I've been to California many times.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the Kings Park and the Yosemite and the
right.
other parks, yeah.
Okay. What has been the impact of the internet on you and doing your work, but also privately? Just to,
a lot. And more so on the scientific life.
Right.
Because nowadays, it's whether you like it or not, you have to live on it. You have to live on this. I probably appreciate it a bit more than other people at my level, because my early training as a grad student in molecular evolution, which requires a lot of work on the computer analysis,
mm-hmm.
sequence comparison, the calculation of sequence similarity like that one. So when the database develops along the way, and I put a lot of attention to it, and I get a benefit. I benefit a lot from it, and that's why I have a close association and my career development with the development of the internet. I read pretty fast, so I can search literature pretty fast, and that's one thing I'm enjoying a lot, that's one thing I'm still enjoying a lot. Once I get on the internet, looking at the database and looking for the other people's publications, typically get off.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, and how about TV? Do you spend much time in front of the tube?
Yeah, we laugh a lot. And other than the traveling, and both my wife and I, and when we get a time, we watch TV, and especially on the weekend. And mm-hmm. that's one thing we love a lot. And also, one thing, and she doesn't share much, is that I like watch politics.
Right.
And I pay a lot of attention to it. And even though I never got involved myself, but I pay a lot of attention to it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, then you're probably going to be excited tonight because you're going to have the presidential debate, right?
Yeah.
And I've been right close from here.
Yeah, I've been following this pretty closely, actually. And
right.
I like this because this is something pretty intriguing to me and something that could have in China.
Yeah.
I don't know, we're not going to have in China. Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. Yeah.
Well, it's very refreshing to hear because, you know, I think the standard American, the average American, is very cynical about politics in general. So.
Right, yeah, and I don't agree with that. And that's probably because of my own experience. And yes, and a lot of American people would think that the politicians are not always telling the truth and they would say anything or say more than they should say and to get elected like
right.
that. But there's no comparison to the politicians in China I know of. Mm-hmm. They don't say anything. You never know what they do behind
right.
you. Yeah, and they like that. Like a king and hiding in the palace and all this traditional life. Only until very recent, start open a little bit. But there's no competition, there's no open dialogue.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm. So I take it you're going to vote then in November?
Oh, yeah.
In a month?
Oh, yeah. This is the first time I can vote, and I just got my citizenship this year. I will vote.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let us play a little make-believe. Let's say you wake up tomorrow morning and you find that your lab has been taken from you. You can no longer practice medicine, or rather biomedical research. What would you do? What would be this alternative career?
Oh, that's a pretty hypothetical. I had never thought about that. If I have to do something to make a living, teaching. I'm a pretty good teacher.
What level?
Well, it has to be high school above. Mm-hmm. I can't deal with anything beyond that.
Right.
But I know I had experience teaching high school in the United States. I don't know how much the kids love to it. If they like to learn as much as the kids I taught in China, I will enjoy it.
Right.
But I think I will enjoy it very much on teaching college level. And I think I can do very well. And that's one thing I always want to do. And I think I will someday.
Mm-hmm.
And when I start and slow down in the lab, and I want to develop a class on the molecular biology on this campus that not just teaching the textbook, but also teaching them the history of science.
Right.
And they give them a historical perspective, how the molecular biology was developed. So they can put the discovery, theory, law of science into the with some kind of personality,
right.
And how to develop it. I don't think that's been taught so far.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that can definitely make a student more exciting and the more interested to learning, as well as in the learning how to do the science in the futures. That would help them.
Right.
Yeah. Because the fact is important, but it's unlimited. And it's there's no personality with the fact associated with this. And it doesn't help you much to think about what you can do when you come to that stage. Because all the scientific discoveries made by scientists, and scientists are human beings, and every scientist, just like every human being, have own personality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Right. Let me turn over the tape. We're getting near the end.